This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 80th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me today Thomas Ridd. Hello, Thomas.
Hi, Gary.
Thomas Ridd is a reader in war studies at King's College London. He's also a fellow at Johns Hopkins's Center for Transatlantic Relations. In the past, Dr. Ridd has worked as a visiting scholar in Jerusalem, at the Wilson Center, at RAND, and at the Institut Français des Relations Internationales in Paris. Ridd's PhD is from the Humboldt University of Berlin, and Ridd's books include Understanding Counterinsurgency, War 2.0, War and Media Operations, and the upcoming 2013 book, Cyber War Will Not Take Place. Thomas lives in the Barbican in the City of London with his wife. So, you've lived in many places in the world throughout your career as a wandering academic.
Yeah.
How has your multicultural life informed your work at the War Studies Department?
That's a great question, and also quite difficult one. The first bizarre experience, really, if you travel around the way I have as a German, and I'm German, you know, spend time in France, the US, UK, Israel, I meet people who my grandfathers used to kill in all places. They tend to, the grandchildren of those people,
right.
And they're all, you know, by and large, so friendly and open-minded to me that this is, you know, quite a remarkable thing if you take a historical perspective.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's an artifact of the modern world and sort of our trend towards multiculturalism on the planet?
I don't think so. It's just the way people deal with, I'm in the Department of War Studies here, so we talk about war all the time. And when we say war, we don't mean a metaphor, we mean the real thing.
Right,
And it's an impressive situation to be close to violence. It impresses you in a very emotional way.
Right.
And I think that lingers on for generations.
So this multicultural gypsy lifestyle of yours, how does it influence the way you approach war studies yourself?
I'm not sure the gypsy lifestyle has an effect. It's more the different perspectives that I was able to witness up close. I always was in a national environment. I was never, you know, in an international organization. But in France, I was among French people, among French officers. Mm-hmm. In Israel, I was among Jews in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty conservative environment, too. So it's always more interesting to be on the conservative side and look at how people perceive their own security environment.
Right.
And that, I think, has informed my work in the sense that I'd like to go into their perspectives and not just look on from an observer's point of view.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. I think we could use some of that in computer security, actually. So you wrote this book, which is going to be published next year, called Cyber War Will Not Take Place. And as you know, I think cyber war is inevitable because of our highly vulnerable systems that we've surrounded ourselves with and that we depend on every day.
Yeah.
So what's up with that with that orthogonal view?
Yeah. So I think if we look at the substance here, then we may actually not have that much disagreement. I mean, on the analysis, I agree. Systems are highly insecure. Especially control systems, industrial control systems, are shockingly insecure if we look at the facts. But the question is more, the disagreement perhaps is a terminological one. You know, one fact is that we've never seen a casualty or a fatality. Nobody has ever died as a result of a cyber attack.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying this is impossible to happen in the future. It may actually happen. I'm quite concerned that it will happen, but up until this point, we haven't seen that, and I'm just hesitant to use this metaphor of war in a lighthearted fashion.
Mm-hmm.
The guy next door literally is studying the First World War, and you know, we're talking something on the order of 36 million casualties in just one war.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like to use metaphors in a lighthearted way.
No, I understand. But I believe that cyber weapons certainly can have a kinetic impact, as Stuxnet shows, and can really destroy real things and kill people, actually.
Yeah.
So you agree that that could happen, just that it hasn't yet, and you want it, the proof is in the pudding? Is that the idea?
Absolutely. I mean, you're raising one of the most tricky, the most hairy questions for cybersecurity today. Given that the state of system security, and especially critical infrastructure security, is actually quite low, that they're not well secured, these systems, why haven't we seen a lethal attack yet,
right.
Given that a lot of people would like to do it?
Right. That's a good question. You know, and in fact, it sort of kind of leads into the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is this hairy problem facing anti-war types, especially anti-cyber war types. That's the issue of deterrence. So maybe as a war studies person, you can explain how deterrence worked during the Cold War and how it might work to deter cyber war.
Yeah. So, of course, I have to simplify here. During the Cold War, deterrence was a very simple situation in a way. You had two main adversaries, the United States and the Soviet Union. They both had nuclear weapons, and they threatened with nuclear retaliation once the other side was using them, the weapons, first. Now, that's a very simple and in some ways, you know, too simple characterization.
Sure, mutually assured destruction is what they referred to it as.
Yeah, exactly. But if we look at deterrence in a domestic context, when we talk about crime, then we have a very different picture. And when we talk about crime, deterring crime means not there's no crime at all, no offenses, no attacks, if you like. Deterring crime means you have a certain statistic that you are trying to keep flat or push down the crime, you know, murder rates, for instance, in a certain jurisdiction. And you do that by threatening law enforcement, and actually not just threatening to use force, you actually do it. So in other words, using force in the domestic context means you maintain deterrence. In an international Cold War context, using force meant that deterrence was breaking down.
Right. So it's sort of the opposite.
Exactly.
I want to push on this notion of deterrence in a more social cultural situation, like inside of the crime situation that you mentioned. So some people have claimed that if you get rid of the graffiti and you clean up the broken windows and you stop petty crime, that stops that has a deterrent effect against, you know, real crime like murder.
Yeah.
And there's some evidence of that. And I'm wondering if anybody has ever used really good defense as deterrence, and whether that's the beginning of that situation in your analogy, and whether we can expand that into a global perspective.
There are a couple of questions in there. The question of defense is very pertinent to deterrence, but in some ways it is an offshoot of deterrence.
Uh-huh.
You need punishment to deter. If you only defend something, like by having a proper lock at your door, you're also deterring potentially attackers. But if we stay in this crime prevention context for a moment, you'd only deter by actually punishing people. If you don't punish people, there's no deterrence.
Okay.
So you have to use force. And then just like to come back to your question, what does that mean for cyber deterrence in the context of computer security? I think first of all, you have to be able to identify a certain number of attacks and then punish people.
Mm-hmm.
And in cybercrime, especially if it's in a domestic context, that it is actually happening because a state is able to find out who did something, a computer crime, and then, you know, start the investigation, and the criminal justice system does its work.
So I might have to quibble with that. I think that sort of kind of works in the United States. It doesn't work at all in Russia, however.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. As soon as you go international, it becomes much more complicated.
Yeah, because international norms are completely different, and the Russians tend to use anti-cybercrime legislation domestically inside of Russia as a way to stop political dissidents.
Absolutely. And think about it this way. If you're able to trace back a certain attack to, say, two schools in China, which happened in the case of the Aurora attack against Google a while ago, at some point you need the log files in order to trace back the attack to, you know, more specific individuals to find out who actually did it.
Right.
For that, it's not a technical problem, it's a political problem. You need the support of a specific government to twist the arm of the ISPs to provide those data.
Right.
Which, of course, China didn't do in that situation.
Not that they didn't have it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I want to get back to this defense as deterrence idea and ask you about Switzerland. Switzerland was able to remain neutral even during, you know, gigantic global conflagrations. And in some sense, that may be due to their defense-related geography.
Indeed.
It's not like they went out and kicked some ass because they didn't have much of an army.
No. Are you suggesting we should, you know, build the security equivalent of the Alps around some computer systems?
No, I like it. I like that a lot. I'm trying to figure out a way to focus some attention on building stuff right instead of, you know, trying to figure out ways to destroy stuff more efficiently.
Yeah.
As a deterrence.
I think you're up to a very, very important point here. In the context of computer attacks, the offense and the defense have are very different when we compare them to, you know, other military confrontations. One of the key questions is, do offensive capabilities translate into a better defense?
Mm-hmm.
In some military contexts, that is the case. But I think it is certainly not the case in the context of cybersecurity.
Hmm. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So this currently overhyped concept of active defense doesn't make much sense?
Let's put it this way. The situations in which you can actually achieve something productive, a positive outcome by doing whatever that exactly is, active defense, I think are quite limited.
Uh-huh.
So I'm totally with you when you say let's focus on getting the defenses right, especially because the attribution problem in some of the most complex international cases is actually quite hard to crack.
I was going to push on that. I was going to ask you a question like this. One word, attribution.
Yeah, exactly. The attribution problem, I'm actually doing a project on the attribution problem right now. And the more work we're doing on the attribution problem, the clearer it becomes to me that it is just not a technical problem. And it's largely seen, even by policymakers like the Secretary of Defense in his recent speech, I believe, it's largely seen as a technical problem. You only need the log files and maybe other forensic methods, and you can point the fingers at the culprit and retaliate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just looking at some of, you know, really any computer crime case, domestic case, what I did, for instance, just give you one example, is in the book I looked at the Burleson case. This was one of the first computer crime cases in the United States from 1987.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no real internet, at least in that case. There was only very simple code involved, simple machines. There was a court trial, a really big court trial too. Lots of witnesses, lots of testimonies. Yet, even in that prehistoric, isolated case, the attribution problem was really hard to solve.
Yeah, maybe you got to figure out who was touching the keyboard or who ran the program or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you read my paper about that I wrote in Search Security recently about cyber war. And I think that leads to this problem of being Gandalfed to use the Bilbo story about Bilbo and the trolls, where, you know, a third party can cause you to get into a cyber war with somebody else that didn't even cause the problem in the first place.
Absolutely. That's one possible scenario. But really, some of the problems that we're having in the context of the attribution problem are much more basic. Oftentimes, it's very hard to tell if you're dealing with a case of computer crime, international computer crime, for instance, or whether you're dealing with a case of some political attack, some espionage attack.
Right.
Even, you know, not even talking about the author, the person who perpetrated the attack, or the institution that did, but just saying very simple things. Are we talking crime? Are we talking espionage? You know, what was the motivation? These are very hard questions that are attribution problem questions.
Right, right. Right, so that makes the whole thing thornier to think about, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think there's another problem related to this offense as defense idea, and that is it's relatively cheap to develop a cyber offense. So it's not clear to me why we wouldn't end up with a huge pile of cyber rocks everywhere in the hands of non-nation state actors, maybe hacker collectives, maybe religious nuts, maybe terrorists, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I think that's a tricky assumption to make, that it is relatively cheap to build offensive cyber weapons. I mean, yes, it depends on what you want to attack. But let's put it this way: if you actually are after the most hardened, well-protected, and complicated targets, mm-hmm. say a power plant, a nuclear power plant, if you actually want to attack such a target, you have to probably not just cause a crash of a system, but actually have to modify output values of a specific control system in order to, for instance, in order to avoid fail-safe mechanisms to,
right.
to take over
right.
and essentially neutralize your attack.
So in order to get around the safety critical design.
Yeah, basically, exactly. And to do that, you don't just need, I mean, maybe if you have, you know, good developers and some creative people working for you, that's quite cheap to do in theory, but in practice, you need target intelligence. You need to know exactly what you're going after.
Okay, so let me make this notion of cheap clear. $90 billion for F-35, you know, stealth fighter wing. We've built one so far. Yay. And, you know, is it $90 billion to attack a nuclear power plant?
Yeah. Well,
or is it way cheaper?
Yes, it probably is. It probably would be cheaper. But my point is, it's very hard to put a price tag on the intelligence that you need.
Got it. I buy that point. I just think that relatively speaking, when we look at defense budgets or offense budgets, as the case may be, we're talking $165 million for one plane, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's another issue here buried in that discussion about the costs of offense versus defense. And that is, if you look at what the United States government is doing, in 2012 and including Stuxnet, which started, of course, earlier, mm-hmm. then you see a number of high-profile offensive operations, Stuxnet, Flame, this Gauss operations, which may also be American-authored, mm-hmm. Against financial institutions in Lebanon, as you may recall.
Yeah, I recall.
So really, what is it that the U.S. government wants? Do they want secure systems in order to be safe at home? Or do they want open, vulnerable systems in order to be able to attack others?
I think that's a great question, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's a very bad idea to have the Department of Defense, and especially the spooks at the NSA, guiding our cyber defense and cyber offense operations simultaneously. They're working at cross purposes, and that's pretty silly.
Yeah, indeed, it is. And I'm not sure what the solution to that problem is. We we should have a better discussion about what kinds of precedents are being currently set mm-hmm. in the arena of offensive cyber operations. Because mm-hmm. really, if you think about it, imagine you're a Chinese senior diplomat and you have a meeting with your American counterparts, and they say to you, China, you're doing all this cyber espionage on American companies, stealing intellectual property, mm-hmm. which is probably correct and probably actually a significant problem, right? Mm-hmm. You can just turn around and say, how dare you? I mean, who is here? Who is pushing the envelope?
You guys are blowing up centrifuges in Iran, which is worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so in a way, you're undermining your credibility. It's not just that you're raising a technical issue, but also politically speaking, it's more counterproductive than probably recognized.
Yeah, very interesting. I think that most technical people don't think about these, I don't know what you call them, these problems that ambassadors have, foreign policy, yeah. and precedents and a way of approaching trying to negotiate with your possible future enemies. Is very interesting.
Yeah. No, but this brings me to something that I wanted to say. You know, when you gave your talk in London here, what I really liked about it, and also some in the audience joined in, some computer scientists in the audience, is it was more self-confident than what I usually hear from people with a technical background. Because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, there are too many people, especially in Washington, but also in other capitals, who do not have a technical background because they're politicians or senior officials,
right.
and they're used to very confident styles when they argue. And sometimes they're just talking about things that they don't properly understand, like, for instance, the
attribution problem. I don't know what you're saying about my talk.
No, I'm saying we need more computer scientists, we need more people with a computer security background mm-hmm. who essentially speak up, who say, oh, listen, if you talk about the attribution problem here, Secretary of Defense, you may want to reconsider some of your facts, because
right.
I don't think you're really on target here.
Right, right. Actually, I wanted to ask you about that. What's the best course for influencing policymakers when it comes to things like cyber war? I mean, does Panetta listen to think tanks? How do we geeks like me get engaged in this process?
It's a great question, and probably a quite difficult one to answer. There are people out there like myself who I don't, obviously, as you probably can tell, I don't have a technical background myself, but I'm trying to understand. There are other people who try to do that as well, who have a long attention span when it comes to technical jargon.
Mm-hmm.
So I would encourage computer scientists to who have an interest in that area to maybe team up with others, to be open towards speaking and spending long hours sometimes with political scientists,
mm-hmm.
the way we do it here at King's College, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Bridging that gap across the disciplines into law, into political science and sociology is really hard. I mean, we speak different languages. But I think it's very important to be able to then turn around and talk in a more educated way for all involved, to people who make decisions.
Yeah, because we're not talking past each other. And I think that's exacerbated in the case of cyber war by talk about jargon. The Defense Department has their own language.
They have their own dictionary. They have a military dictionary to sort of translate their own jargon.
Yeah, as a little aside, I wrote this piece and I used the term active defense the way that Ellen Nakashima and other people were using it in the popular press. And I got an email from Dorothy Denning, who I have great respect for, and she said, "You're misusing the term active defense. Here's the actual definition from the military code."
Yeah.
That was interesting.
Yeah. There's a lot of that, miscommunications.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about is what lessons war scholars can teach computer security people.
Whenever computer scientists, computers in general, really technicians, not just computer scientists, develop new technologies, new methods, they often use metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
Think about firewall. Many of the basic expressions that we use, like packets, really are metaphors.
Yeah, even and virus.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so if we talk about cyber weapons, for instance, we are in this gray area between, is it a metaphor that we're talking about, or actually, you know, real cyber weapons? So there, this is just one example. I think there are many examples where political scientists, people from with my background, can come in and maybe provide some conceptual clarity in a debate that oftentimes lacks the conceptual clarity.
Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of examples that come to mind immediately, like this notion of asymmetric warfare or counterinsurgency, and there are a lot of people in computer security who throw those terms around in very sloppy ways, actually.
Yeah. So let's make an example with insurgency and anonymous. Oftentimes you see people referring to anonymous as an insurgent movement or as potentially, you know, terrorists, and of course that's highly problematic in many ways. So the way I see this is that people with a different background, especially when we talk about social movements, really like anonymous, like other online movements, we are just able to provide some more clarity and some background about motivations, about why this is happening, about the limitations of what it can't possibly achieve in the future.
And how it's different from something like Al-Qaeda.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously the differences are vast here. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to turn that question around, too. So what lessons can computer security teach war scholars?
Oh, that's much easier to answer, I think. Everybody, not computer security people, people who are doing security and strategic studies, as we call it, or just political scientists in this field, we tend to be lazy, and we feel more comfortable in our own environment. So I think it's important to be pushed and really to ask some tough questions about the technical understanding that people have, to explain in very simple terms some things that you will find utterly boring, but that many people in our field will not understand. So it's important to be patient and to explain some of the background.
Mm-hmm.
At the same way, we also have to explain some of the political background to computer scientists,
right?
Like, for instance, how lobbying works if you want to affect a political debate.
Yeah, so let's get back into that a little bit. You know, do think tanks work?
Do think tanks work?
I mean, I know they pay some people some salaries, and we support some scholarly work, but does it really matter? Do the policymakers actually read that stuff? I guess they kind of come from those places.
Yeah. So it's not just, I think it's important to see that think tanks work in multiple ways, in many dimensions. It's not just what they write that may not matter. So, but let's be realistic. If the Rand Corporation puts out a report with 300 pages,
mm-hmm.
almost no politician is going to read those 300 pages.
I'm not sure some of them can read, actually.
Well, I've seen politicians who can read, so and they would probably read the executive summary. They would certainly have a conversation with people from Rand. I worked for Rand for a while, and you know, we were over in the Pentagon on a regular basis to brief people, to have interactions in person.
Right.
Of course, that has an effect. And even better is if you start working in the policy environment after a while, and then go back to your think tank,
mm-hmm.
and you create this link in, you know, between people. And that's
so,
what matters.
So it's the networking is just as important.
Absolutely,
so when
yeah.
I went to see Panetta speak at the CNES thing, the fact that we were all in the same room was the key.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. So just to you know, get back to your question, how can people with a technical background, computer security people, influence what politicians think? You know, the simple answer is don't be shy. Talk to them if you get the chance and engage. You know, give talks and go to talks and get outside your comfort zone and don't just talk to other computer security people in jargon, but actually transcend the jargon and go talk to policy people.
Right.
I mean, you're doing this, but I think many more people should do it.
Right. That's good advice, I think. And so now a question from left field. When I was in London earlier this month, you told me about the Barbican. I suppose I'm saying that right, where you live.
Yeah.
How did you end up there? First of all, tell us what it is, and then
yeah.
how'd you end up there?
So the Barbican is a cultural center in London. The London Symphony Orchestra plays there. It's a couple of cinemas and theaters and restaurants, but also it's a huge apartment complex. So it's the ultimate modernist dream. You have almost a small town within a huge town that is secluded and functions as a separate entity. And I just found this vision of this 1960s urbanist modernist utopia quite appealing, mm-hmm. because it actually works, and it's a slightly bizarre environment to live in.
It sort of reminds me of some stuff from Snow Crash.
Yeah, it's
just to hook in a little Stevenson for no apparent reason.
You may know the French architect Le Corbusier, yeah. who designed these outlandish plans for Paris and Algiers.
Yeah.
He strongly influenced that development. So it's fun to be there because it's like other people drive old timers, cars, and motorbikes, and I really really love these old timers, but people who live in the Barbican have the same type of relationship to the building. So I kind of like that.
Right. Very cool. Well, thanks for your time, Thomas. This has been a good conversation.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The September-October issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue on e-voting security. Although we've already done our voting in the States, ever wonder about the security of your voting machines? See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.